Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Gentlemen, I'm Alfred Adisk here on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. I'm here with co-host Roger Sales. Roger is calling in from Argentina. He'll be on in a moment. First, we'll do the market reports. Gold is up $11.40 per ounce. $1,594.20 per ounce. Hooray. Gold, silver's up 20 cents per ounce, $29.29 per ounce. Platinum is down $3 to $1,601. Palladium is down $6 to $776 per ounce. In the equities markets, Dow Jones is down 6 points to 14,441. NASDAQ is off 12 points to 3,241. New York Stock Exchange is down 21 points to 9,061. U.S. dollar is flat at 82.58 on the U.S. dollar index. Crude oil is up 48 cents to $92.54 per barrel. Roger Sales is our guest. Roger is the author of From Sovereign to Serfs. Roger, are you there?
I'm right here, Al. How you doing this afternoon?
Good, good, good. Glad to have you on the program, Roger. What's new in Argentina?
Well, I just got finished reading an article. I was just reading it there as you were doing this wonderful little metals report when we see gold taking a perk for the first time in a little while. They sure are conscious of that $1,600, aren't they?
Yeah.
They just had a, you know, this row. We've talked about it before on here. It's been ongoing for some time. The row between Argentina and Britain over the Falkland Islands that they call here the Malvinas. And evidently they had a there's like, I don't know, 2,500 people that live on the island in the one main town called Stanley, and they put everything to a referendum, and 92% of the people voted, came out to vote, and they voted overwhelmingly to be British. So I don't know what's going to happen. You know, it was an interesting little article. It's over on Drudge. And we got a lot of stuff going on, man. I mean, the whole world, as we're saying last week, that, you know, if we were in the war games, we'd say this is a target-rich environment, buddy.
Yeah, that's the truth. Again, it just keeps on quivering like one of those glasses in the old Memrex commercial. That's an analogy I use repeatedly, but it hasn't. The glass has not shattered, but it is quivering around the world, in the Middle East, a little bit down South America, up here in the United States, Europe, Asia. Japan and China are threatening, they're threatening each other over a couple of rocks out in the middle of the, well, not the middle, but adjacent to Japan and China. There's a couple of rocks out in the middle of the ocean.
Kind of like the Malvinas, a couple of rocks out there.
Kind of like Malvinas, but the question, but at least you got to give the Asians credit. There is allegedly there's allegedly great quantity of natural gas under their rocks. What do you got?
Well, there are in the, absolutely the same thing. In fact, they're already starting to drill out there already in some of the royalty checks. Yeah, and they were going to some of these people that were in the that voted in the referendum are getting royalty checks. Gee, I wonder how they're going to vote.
Yeah, I wonder how they're going to vote. Well, then it begins. It all begins to make sense. We're going to have to call in Miss Marple here, Dunders, to explain what's happening. But
You know, the other thing about the Malvinas, and I'm not sure about the, is it the Spratlin Islands or something over there by Japan? It's some, I don't remember the name, but I know the incident, and but I thought it was the Spratlins. I may be wrong. But the Malvinas, the Falklands down here, if you look at a map, they came when Argentina originally was founded by Spain. Spain controlled those islands. And Argentina's claim is when they got their independence from Spain, the islands came with them. All right.
Yep.
And the interesting thing is, yes, there's evidently beaucoups of gas and oil out there. And that evidently is what the original fight in the 80s was about.
So this but isn't just an opportunity to raise a couple hundred head of sheep.
Yeah. Or penguins and stuff, because they got penguins and whales and all that stuff down there. But if you think in geopolitical terms, if you look at that on a map, that is the control of the southern Atlantic. And now you're talking about control all the way down into Antarctica. And that is super rich with minerals, period.
I agree with what you're saying, but the Malvinas aren't that large, are they? I mean,
they're
it's not
good
like
size. They got, a natural... But they got a natural deep harbor, I think.
They do.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I know it's I understand it's like Midway Island out in the middle of the Pacific. It has great strategic value because it doesn't float. It'll actually sit there even if the wind blows and the waves rise. Midway will still stay there. The Malvinas are the same thing. So it has strategic value, but I don't know.
It just seems to me that this whole thing is about ready to blow. And I, as long as I've been in this for many years and as close attention as I've paid for many years to this, dedicated, I don't remember a time when I've seen more potential fireworks, Roman candles going off in so many different areas in so many different parts of the world.
And it makes you wonder. I mean, it makes the hair rise on the back of your neck if you stop to think about it. How long can we see these potentials for violence, you know, kind of bouncing around? Maybe they happen, maybe they won't, but when you see one or two or five or ten, how many do you have to see before you begin to wonder if somebody's not going to do something stupid and all of a sudden there's going to be nuclear wars? Is that an irrational fear? Do you think that's unreasonable and irrational?
I don't think it's unreasonable or irrational at all. In fact, this morning, and I meant to compliment you this on this publicly, you did a wonderful job on Joyce's show this morning.
Thank you.
And right after you, they had this Greg Marinaro guy on there who's a pretty crackerjack analyst. I've got some friends that have been sending me his stuff for months with his little charts and everything that he shows. And he's very good. He's got a lot of good experience. But he just came right out and said that on the hour after you were on this morning. He said, you can just expect war out of this, brothers and sisters. Okay.
Well, in terms of economic problems, we're not so different from the problems that we saw in the Great Depression, and they were not simply confined to the United States. They involved Great Britain, foreign countries, and international trade, and there are a certain amount of similarities where governments became overly indebted, and then they go to war. And that appears to have been perhaps part of the foundation for World War II. We can reasonably wonder, here we have a government right now, it's bankrupt. The United States government can't possibly pay its debts. It's part of the reason it has to borrow money just to maintain current spending levels. It can't possibly pay its own debts, even on an annual basis, let alone the $200 billion in national debt that's accumulated over time, according to Congressional Budget Office.
$200 trillion, not billion.
Yeah, exactly. I meant trillion, but said billion. You get to a point where these words, you know, billions, trillions, quadrillions, Brazilians. That was the thing. That was the thing Bush got caught up on, was how many are in a Brazilian, you know.
We need to have
words with completely different sounds to indicate whether we're talking about billions, quadrillions, whatever. What are we talking about here anyway?
Well, I don't know, but it struck me funny because I got some friends that are going to Brazil for vacation today. They're in the air right now. So when you said that, it struck me funny. But it's a hell of a time to be alive, Al. And not only that, you know, that you and myself and the listeners that take their time to listen to us in these discussions on a weekly basis or daily or however much attention they pay, is that we at least have some semblance of what's happening. But think of the poor sheeple out there that are still totally in the illusion by choice or by ignorance, one of the two, and that are going to get hit with this thing broadside.
I understand. I was just writing an article about this, that government now accounts for 40% of the gross domestic product. That's local, state, and federal government. Now, that can't continue. It means we've got two classes. We've got a 60% of the population who are productive and independent in the private sector. We have 40% of the population who are, to some degree, greater or lesser degree, they're dependent on government welfare, subsidies, grants, pensions, and employment. Now, we have a government that is legally bankrupt. And sooner or later, it's not going to be able to afford all of its dependents. It's going to have to tell at least a big chunk of them, sorry, boys, we can't make the bills, we can't pay your bills anymore.
No, no.
What happens to the economy at that time?
They're never going to do that. You know, I don't remember if it was Ed Dirksen or one of those old senators when he was confronted about this 40, 50 years ago when he said, oh, don't worry, we'll pay them.
We'll pay them with what, though?
Well, of course, that's it, with inflated dollars.
Yeah. Well, we're going to pay them with dollars that are worth maybe a quarter or even a dime compared to what they're worth today.
Or less.
Yeah, we'll see. They'll get paid nominally, but they won't get paid in terms of value. Let's take a call from George. He's calling from Detroit. George, are you there?
Yes, I am. Last week, Tuesday, both of you covered the definition of a resident pretty well, but not being a resident, not wanting to be a resident, I think I got the status to be in is a sovereign. Is it one word, or is it a sovereign individual, or a sovereign inhabitant?
George, hold it, time out. I'm going to give you a little bit of real good Southern advice right here, buddy. You purge that word from your lexicon. You don't want to be a sovereign, because then the FBI agent and the sovereign division, if you go around waving that banner, are going to be on you like a duck on a June bug. I maintain that if you're going to fight these guys in this lexicon arena, that you use their words.
And
so
your recommended word is?
That word, according to my research and everything that I've experienced personally, that political status is a U.S. national. That's how they identify it on the passport application, in the Nationality Act of 1940, in the statutes at large. And if you understand those basic concepts and how they twist and confuse these concepts and words, you can follow that all the way through the code and all the way through the regulations, except Title 26, where they change it to non-resident. An alien, and you can follow. It's the political status. It's not what they call it. That's why we have to come back, and it will behoove you greatly to understand concepts and approach this as you figure it out and get all the little blocks straight in your mind. You think conceptually. Don't be identifying it with their words, because they change the words to confuse you. It's just like them changing mercantilism to free trade. It's the same blasted thing. Oh, free trade. Oh, it's something new. No, it's something old. It's been around for hundreds of years. It's called mercantilism.
So, well, I disagree with you.
The definition then is just U.S. national, not individual or inhabitant either?
I'm telling you what I would do, George, okay, personally. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
That's how I would approach this. I want to use the words that they're using, knowing the definitions they're imputing into them. And to my way of thinking, and I've put many thousands of hours into study and thinking on this, that little thing right there is the key to the matrix. If you can use the words that they are using with the same definitions, then you're talking apples and apples. In other words, I heard Alex Jones one day saying, when he's out in Vegas in a shooting something with Jesse Ventura, and he got stopped for speeding, and the cop came up to the car, and the first question he asked him, "Are you a citizen of the United States?"
Mm-hmm. And so his answer was?
Well, I'm sure it was yes. Well, boom, there's jurisdiction right there.
Yeah. Well, here's now, I'm not going to agree with you on objecting to the use of sovereign. I think the government is trying to vilify the use of the word sovereign because they don't want people to get close. For me, this is the key. Now,
of course,
I have a way of arguing this, and I have a certain system. I go from point one to point two to point three, and I like the word sovereign. Roger does not. He has a different argument. You may develop a third argument, George. You may have a different way, but the point is there is not necessarily one correct answer. There may be a number of arguments, however, that can get away from one fundamental problem, and that is federal government jurisdiction over you. And that's what we're talking about, and how do you go about that? Roger has one strategy. I have another strategy. You may come up with a third one, George, but one of the points is you can't just take my strategy or Roger's strategy or anybody's strategy and say, well, I'll just copy that. You got to know what's going on here, because if you have to bump heads with these people, it's exactly like getting into a fight in a back alley around midnight. You had better be able to throw a punch, not just hand over a piece of paper. You've got to know, and that requires study. It requires knowledge. It requires dumb luck and the grace of God sometimes. But you got to be, you don't have to be perfect, but you got to be better than whoever it is you're arguing against. And that means prosecutors, perhaps.
However you want to come to the understanding and the comfort level to where you take the step, George, to me, it seems like Al's saying exactly, no matter which course you choose, know that information cold.
Yeah. And you got to know
it. What the words they are using and their definitions.
You go into their codes. You look in their codes. They have scores, if not hundreds, and perhaps thousands, of instances in the United States Code where they give you a section called definitions. And the definitions for one title and one section of the title may be completely different than the same words defined in another title or another section of the same title. I mean, they're constantly jamming it full of definitions, and you have to be able to read those definitions and discern what they mean. You got to be able to read and compare, and it takes time and study.
Let me add something for George here. You know, in a lawsuit, George, if you ever want to get into litigation stuff, you can, even as a plaintiff, Joe Blow George from Detroit, you can go in and write a lawsuit, and you can define your terms in that lawsuit that black is white, green is yellow, up is down. You can put all that in that lawsuit, and for the rest of the time that lawsuit is active, whether it goes to appeals, whether it goes to certiorari in the Supreme Court, as long as that thing is active, whatever words you defined in that initial pleading are the words that are associated with that suit the rest of the time of its life.
Now, definitions are critical. Roger is correct, but here's one thing Roger's overlooked. Time to start our commercials was about 20 seconds ago, so we're going to break right now, and we will be back with Roger and George in just a couple of minutes. Please stay tuned, folks.
Financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Attisker in Financial Survival with Roger Sales. We are talking about what are the magic words, if there are such things as magic words, that might be able to minimize your exposure to unwanted attention by the federal government. What are some of the words you might want to use that might attract their attention? All right. Roger says he wants to stay away from the word sovereign because he thinks it'll attract attention. I say I want to grab hold of that word sovereign because I think I can use it. And on top of which, I believe sovereignty flows from God. For me, sovereignty is a spiritual foundation for the term that gives me an extra layer of protection, an extra layer of argument, an extra layer of what I think is my obligation to the good Lord. So I'm going to grab hold of that sovereignty issue, but I'm not saying it's a perfect solution.
Well,
I'm not saying it's ideal. I'm just saying my preference. Go ahead.
You know, Al, I don't disagree with you either, and I totally concur with you on your feelings about the word and where it comes from and everything that it means. But and you could take this argument in a sticky situation, and you could sit down and deal with it. But you and I are not the average people out there.
I agree.
You know, people like George that are asking these questions about things like resident and things like that. George, let me ask you a question. Have you purchased and read my book?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, I highly advise you. You're cutting in and out on me. I'm here. Say, what were you going to say?
I was hoping to get your phone number.
Okay, well, I'm not going to give that out on the air, but you can go to my website and hit contact, and you can shoot me an email, and we'll deal with it on the side. The point I wanted to make is this. It's not necessarily – one thing that I've learned with this over all the years that's helped me so much is I don't ever look at things straight on the way they want you to. I've learned to look at things in reverse and come at these things from an opposite side because that's the way they've set them up. And that's the way they're using them. So as opposed to going to the words and trying to define and chase the definition, I go back to the basics and the concepts. When I understand the concepts, then I can plug the words into it. So let me give you an example. We know that you can only get your rights one of two places. You either get them from God or you get them from man. Now, there's no other places you can get rights or you have correlative duties that you owe. So if you go to that passport application and look at the oath, what is there? I swear under penalty of perjury I'm a citizen of the United States, parentheses, or a non-citizen national, parentheses. Well, there's two rights, one's from God, one's from man. We know we're not the 14th Amendment federal citizens that we've been tricked into assuming that political status for most of or all of our lives, depending on who you are. So it's, once again, it's having the background to look at this facade and be able to work your way through it, because people just attack the facade without knowing their enemy. Maybe that's the point I'm trying to get across. Is you're going to figure this stuff out and you're going to fight these guys. It's just like Sun Tzu said over 2,000 years ago. If you don't know your enemy, you've only got a 50% chance of winning any battle. And if you don't know your enemy and you don't know yourself, you got no chance of winning any battle.
I've been starting my education and listening to both of you. And here's something else that maybe you could tackle. Article 1, Section 6 of the Michigan Constitution states, every person has a right to keep and bear arms for the defense of himself and the state. Would you want to tackle the word person?
I'd be happy to. A person is an entity to whom the law ascribes rights and duties. Okay? It's an entity. It can be an individual. It can be a corporation. It can be a trust. It can be an LLC. It can be a partnership. It can be any of those things. So it's any of those things that the law ascribes rights that has correlative duties. So in your question about the Michigan Constitution, any person, parentheses, who has God-given constitutionally protected rights, close parentheses, has a right to the Second Amendment. That's exactly what that says.
So that wouldn't include a U.S. national also, right?
No, it is. That's the same.
Oh.
That's what I'm telling you. The old original capital C citizen in the Declaration of Independence, where Thomas Jefferson says we all get our rights from the Creator, and they're unalienable or inalienable, whichever one you want to say it is. That's that status. And that's why I say you can't go over here and start looking at this word and that word and that word. You go back and learn the concepts. Then you plug the words into them.
There's an educational hurdle here, and the reality. And even on one level, when you start early in this thing, there is an unfortunate reality that it requires a great deal of education. Most of that education is self-education. Most of it will be a reflection of your own determination to educate yourself. And it won't happen in, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. I'm at it now 30 years and I'm still learning. I don't anticipate to see the end of my education. All right, when I stop learning more, that'll be the point they will pronounce me DOA. You understand? He's not learning anymore. You don't have to check for his pulse or brainwaves. Just find out, is he still learning things or not? If he's not learning, he's dead. He's gone. I expect it to continue throughout the balance of my life, and you're going to have to do that too. And you'll have to be the kind of person who enjoys and even celebrates learning.
George, let me tell you something to put what Al just said into perspective. I've been in this 20 and a half years, and I mean up over my eyeballs, all right? And I still learn and understand new things almost weekly after 20 years of being total immersed in it.
Yeah. Yeah. But here's the thing, George. You don't have to have perfect knowledge. You only have to know more than your adversary when you go to court. You understand? It's like any kind of a boxing match. You don't have to be Mike Tyson to win the match. You just have to be a better boxer than the guy you're bumping heads with.
You just have to be Holyfield. You bite his ear off.
Yeah, something like it. Yeah, yeah. It's a little. You're probably not a good idea to bite the prosecutor's ear off, especially not in court. Then they'll say for sure that guy must be a sovereign. He just chewed somebody's ear off.
You know? No, that's anti-Semitic.
All right. Well, whatever. I lost my point. I'm not used to mixing litigation and cannibalism in the same metaphor, but here we are.
You got to be on your toes when you're with me, man. George,
I guess.
Listen, go to my website, buddy. I don't plug this enough, so Al's going to give me a chance to do this here. Go to the triple W's, and I'll say it, and then I'll spell it for you. It's surfs-up.com. That's SERFS-UP.COM. And you can read a whole bunch of stuff on there. You can go back and listen to some of my other broadcast interviews that are on there. You can download. You can hit the contact button and send me an email. You can do all that stuff right there. And you contact me, and, you know, I'll give you a hand. But you got to read the book, and you got to do a lot of this on your own. I can't handhold you.
Right.
Well, right now I don't have a computer online, but I'm sure glad that both of you have informed me and other people about differences, definitions between what we commonly use and what the legal definition is. That was very enlightening.
Yeah, that's their whole game. Their whole facade, this everything they've been able to accomplish is done with that trick right there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitions, virtually every word you'll ever find. There are exceptions, but almost every word you ever find have more than one definition. Or has,
you know,
more,
George,
than one definition. And the question is, they frequently say, well, and they'll use a word, and they know they mean one definition, and they know you'll think they mean a different definition, and they'll ask you a question, and you'll say yes, and they will understand you because you did not say, well, what do you mean by the definition of that word? Because you didn't get them to specify. You'll say yes, and they'll say, fine, you've just admitted what we want you to admit. It is a fundamental strategy.
On an example that I used in this conversation with George a minute ago, with Alex Jones, if out there in New Mexico or Las Vegas, if he'd have been stopped and that cop walked up and said, are you a U.S. citizen? He said, no, I'm a U.S. national. Now, we don't know how that conversation would have ended up, but can you see what I'm saying about using the correct words?
Yeah. And even now, here's the problem. You can use the correct words, but you can use them with someone who doesn't understand the correct words. For example, in the illustration we're using, Alex Jones deals with a cop. Alex Jones, he says the correct words. What if the cop doesn't understand what he's talking about?
We still have a problem, and
it won't iron out in your favor until you can show perhaps a judge, maybe even a judge on appeal, that I used the right words back there in the original confrontation. And in theory, eventually someone will say, oh, wait a second, that damn cop, he didn't know what you're talking about. All right, dismiss the charges, get him out of here. But there's a human element in every one of these confrontations, George. And some people don't understand what you're talking about, and some people are malicious, and they don't care what you're talking about. And they'll still do what's wrong. They know it's wrong, they'll do it anyway, and bet that you don't have enough intelligence and courage and resources to do anything about it.
You know, George, your question and call last week has had me thinking all week, I have to tell you, because something after the show started turning over in my mind about your resident question. And you remember with early in the answer from last week, we talked about Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, and the two definitions of resident are right there in the Collegiate Dictionary. You know, the first one, the act or fact of living and dwelling in a place for some time. The second one, that exact language for the receipt of a benefit or the discharge of a duty. And what my thoughts were in retrospect last week were, did they go back and set this up with using that word? 80, 100 years ago? Did they come and impute the legal word and definition of resident and come back and stick it in a geographical text and use that as a building block to build this whole damn thing? That's what has been in my mind all week. And somebody needs to get into the Oxford English Dictionary, where you can go in and see the etymology of a word, and you can go find resident, and it'll tell you where it was used first and where. Boom, 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 boom. It'll list them. And somebody, if somebody wants to be diligent and do some research, but that's a big question I've had all week, Al. I wanted to talk about it today. So it's great that George called in again.
Let me ask you this. Tell me again which dictionary you are reading from with the definitions that you cited for resident.
Webster's Collegiate Dictionary.
Okay. Here's why I'm asking. You part of the definition that I heard you say, maybe I didn't hear correctly, was resident is one who can either receive benefits or perform duties and obligations. I can't remember the exact language that you just cited, you just quoted. But you said something to do with benefits, something to do with, or something to do with duties.
Well, let me requote it for the audience and for you, Al. If you go to that dictionary, you'll see the first definition is the geographical definition.
Yeah.
The act or fact of living or dwelling in a place for some time.
Yeah.
That's the geographical definition. Now, in number two, they take that exact thing. I got some construction going on downstairs, so pardon me. The act or fact of living or dwelling in a place for some time, same exact definition, for the receipt of a benefit or the discharge of a duty. Benefits
now,
and duties,
or
put that in the legal.
Put yeah, that the legal, and either. What I'm hearing is a party to a trust relationship. The receipt of benefits signifies a beneficiary. The discharge of a duty can signify a fiduciary who has obligations and duties to perform under the trust. It suggests that a resident could be construed as a member, a party to a trust relationship. Maybe a fiduciary, maybe a beneficiary, but a party to a trust relationship. Does that make sense to you?
Let's go back to Maitland. If you go back to Maitland was one of the great English jurists, okay? And he goes into it in some of his writings. It's in my book. And he says, these terms could be substituted for entitled and bound.
All right, And entitled, I would guess that entitled refers to the beneficiary who is entitled to certain rights, and bound would refer to the fiduciary who is obligated to perform certain duty.
If you wanted to keep that in pure,
but I can make that interpretation.
Well, if you wanted to keep it in purely in a trust discussion, you could apply that there exclusively. But when you talk about entitled and bound, entitled, isn't that also entitlements? So those people aren't necessarily in a trust relationship, we don't know for sure, that are getting all these entitlements from the federal government.
Well, what relationship do you think they have with the federal government?
They've got a citizenship relationship. The federal government owns them. They're their property, and they have civil rights, and they're entitled to entitlements. And when they receive the entitlements, they got duties, because there are always duties attached with benefits, privileges, entitlements, small r rights. That's a good illustration of what we've been talking about here, is you could go in and dice these words up, but if you understand the concepts, they're all the same thing. Entitlement, benefits, rights, all those things can be interchanged.
Well, the problem with all of this is there are, you look at this thing, and the word rights and the word entitlement, under some circumstances, they mean one thing. Under other circumstances, they mean another. You see the words, and they imply. We're either in this arena or in that arena. And if you don't make it your business to expressly inquire, what are you guys talking about? What do these words mean? You can't ask me to respond to questions if I don't know what the words mean. And no one wants to ask, what is the meaning of these words? And you've got to. And you got to, does this mean we're in equity, or are we at law? Are we in admiralty?
See,
are we? Is this an administrative proceeding? Please tell me the nature of the process we're dealing with. And the words, depending on which arena you're in, different implications, different definitions, different meanings.
you know, you brought up something real critical there that I thought about just a couple of days ago. I wanted us to talk about on these shows, Al. You just said nature. You know, in the Constitution.
I'll tell you what else we're going to say. I'll tell you what other word am I going to say. Commercial announcements. Okay, yeah. We're going to have to deal with the nature. We're going to get back to nature when we return in the third segment of the program. I'm Alfred Addis here with Roger Sills. Be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Countries have denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a KU band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis, here on Financial Survival with Roger Sales. The program is brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Give Melody Cedarstrom a call. She should be there now. 1-800-375-4188. Roger and I, George has departed. George was on the line. He's not here anymore. From Detroit, and we have been talking about a number of words, and the reason this is important, a lot of people in the audience listening, oh, big damn deal, a bunch of words, who cares what all the meanings of the words are? Let me tell you something. If you are concerned that you are on the verge of becoming a slave, to some degree, that idea, the government wants to reduce you to the status of a subject, they want you as a slave, they want you just in a position where you must just follow orders. Now, if that concerns you, you have to recognize that you will not be reduced to the status of a slave by some police officer or military individual packing a gun or a club. You will be enslaved, if you're going to be enslaved, by the adept use of words. And what we're trying to do on this program is make people sensitive, in this program, today's program, we're trying to make you sensitive to the importance of language. You have how many dictionaries do you have, Roger?
Well, I don't have any hardly with me, but, you know, I had a whole bunch back there in the U.S. I couldn't bring them all down with me. The best dictionary in the world is the Oxford English Dictionary. If you go into any library, it's about 13 volumes up on the shelf. And as I said earlier, it goes into etymology of the word, where it came from, its earliest usage, exactly where those came from, what the years were, etc. And you can take and trace any word through that dictionary. I personally had their condensed edition, which is condensed 13 volumes down to two. But, man, you got to have an electronic microscope to read that stuff on.
I understand. It's like printing on the head of a pen. Pin.
Yeah, you know, you go into
point.
English dictionaries.
Here's my point. I've got a dozen dictionaries, Roger, and you can easily, those are Black's first through 10th. I probably have, or 9th, Black's first through 9th. I've got 8 of them. I think I'm missing one, but I've got more that are on the Internet. You can download them off the Internet, and the only point I'm trying to make is you must master the language. This is all done with words. You will be free or you will be jailed, depending on your ability to master the meaning of the words, the grammar. If you can do that, you can hold these people at bay. You don't have to shoot. You don't have to bomb. You don't have to kill anybody. But you must learn how to read, write, and even speak fluently. And it's something they certainly don't teach you in school today.
They go out of their way not to teach in school.
I understand that.
One of the big pieces of the puzzle, George, if you're still listening, I assume is something I got out of one of Pastor Pete's sermons years ago. This wasn't what the sermon's about, but it's, you know, as you get the background here and you go through your life and you're conscious, you find those pieces of the puzzle that you plug in. And the big one for this little, what we're talking about right here, came from a sermon with Pastor Pete, and it's out of the Old Testament. I wish I knew what book it's in. I do not. But he told the story in the middle of a sermon. And in that book, in the Old Testament, either the Canaanites or the Amalekites or some of those guys were warring against an adjacent tribe. They wanted their land. They wanted their resources. Nothing new under the sun, right?
Kind of like Malvinas or the little islands out there between, exactly.
The Spratlands, whatever they are. And so they're walking. They called, conjured up Baal. And they were walking with Baal and asking Baal, of course, that's the Old Testament version of the devil, what we would, conceptualize as the devil these days. And they're walking along, and they said, how can we defeat this other tribe? And Baal said, trick them with words.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And that's exactly what's happened to us. And when I say us, I mean the American people. We have been deceived by the clever and sophisticated use of language, and the only defense to it is you must also master the language. You don't even know what these people are doing to you until you figure out the words.
Don't have a clue. That's why that Voltaire quote, when I read, I don't know the context of it or anything else, but all I had to do was see that sentence. And he said, before we discuss, let us define our terms. Voltaire knew.
I've been saying for a couple of years now, the definitions are the law of the law.
Yeah, that's a good
what I mean by that. When you say thou shalt not kill, what does it mean? It depends on what are the definitions of the words in that law. And if you want to raise those definitions and begin to dispute them and say, well, does it mean this or does it mean this? You, in my opinion, might be astonished at how much traction you can gain if you can master the definitions. They say the words, and they say, do you understand? And everybody says, yeah, I understand. They don't want to admit they're ignorant. They don't want to admit they have no clue to what it means. I understand. You don't understand. Crap. Get yourself a bunch of dictionaries and start to learn what words mean and begin to appreciate them. Then you may be able to hold these people at bay.
It's the Inspector Columbo approach.
One other thing here. Okay.
One more question. That's exactly right. We got a caller, Bruce from Austin, Texas. Bruce, are you there?
Yes, I had a question for Roger. On his passport and his state-issued ID, does he remember, was there any of those names in all caps, or did it have an initial period on either of those documents?
They're in all caps, and I don't think that's – I think that's a nefarious argument myself, and my teachers and I have discussed this at length over the years, and we think that that's nefarious. May not be. I don't know. It does say in the passport application, though, no matter what the letters are capitalized, it says the bearer of this is a U.S. citizen slash national.
Okay. Also, follow-up is – what implication do you think this not being a U.S. citizen would have on work if they do E-Verify and they want 1099s and
on the I-9, and I don't know how they're updating all these forms, okay, because I'm not up there. But on the older I-9 I saw just a couple of years ago, one of the selections you had was U.S. National. In fact, I had a student who got a – he was retired, and he got a job, a civil service job, and he went in, and he had not filed an affidavit, but he asked me about it, and I said, well, I don't know what to tell you to do. Why don't you just check it? And so he checked U.S. National on his first day at work, right? He went to work the rest of the day. He comes in the next day, and the boss calls him in his office and says, if you don't change this, you don't have a job.
Hmm.
Somebody knows.
My question.
Okay. And if you want to go back, and this is why it's important with the concepts, that U.S. National over in the IRS regulations in 26 CFR 1.1-1A, it calls it a non-resident alien. It's a different word, but it's the same concept. There's only two places. One's a citizen of the United States and a resident. The other is a non-resident alien. It's got to be that concept. See, Bruce? So they change it. That's why it took me 15 years until I saw that passport application, because they change it everywhere when you're studying the code. But I knew that the State Department was in charge of everything to do with all matters concerning citizenship, and the passport application's got to be one of their most important forms for the public, okay? So the head office in the government that's in charge of this, and this is their most important form, I know damn well they got it right in there, because it's got an OMB number, an Office of Management and Budget number, and they got to jump through a bunch of hoops to get one of those things.
Okay.
All right.
Well, that's very good. I look forward to reading your book and learning some more about this. Those two things you mentioned a couple of weeks ago sound very interesting.
I'll tell you what, you read it a lot more than once, because anybody that gets everything in that book in one read is an absolute genius. There's a bunch in there, man.
All right, Bruce.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. Let me ask you a question here out of the recent news, Roger. We've seen an article where the new head of the CIA, Brennan, he takes his oath on a draft constitution without the Bill of Rights. Do you think that's significant or not?
I sure do, and to notice how they played it, see. Oh, this is the constitution that George Washington took his oath on. You see how they're playing it to the public?
Well, I'm looking at it, and I'm not necessarily – see, the constitution, whatever he's taken his oath on – all right, he's not taking it on the Bible. Oh, that's the first thing I'd give you. He's not taking an oath to God, perhaps. I don't know. He's not taking the oath on the Bible. If he's taking an oath on a draft of the Constitution, it still includes Article 5, which allows for the amendments. He would implicitly be taking it on the basis, he would implicitly include the amendments, even though they're not part of the particular document he's got his hand on. And what's the other thing that was crossing my mind? What did he say? On one level, I'm not whether he swore, whether he took an oath on the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, or the rules for a Monopoly game. I'm not necessarily the most critical fact. What did he say in his oath?
Well, with Brennan, I don't think it matters, because he had his fingers crossed behind his back.
No, I didn't. He's got, I can see the picture here. He's got one hand on the document, the other hand
Then his toes are crossed in his shoes.
I think his eyes are crossed. I think that's a requirement to be a government employee these days. You have to have cross eyes. But I'm not sure whether this is sinister, whether this is much ado about nothing. And I'm looking at this.
I look for in these things, Al, I look for how they couch it. I look for how they present it to the GDP, the generally dumb public, because that's who they're trying to fool.
Well, I don't know if they're necessarily even trying to fool the generally dumb public. They got them fooled. That's a given. As long as they're drinking fluoride out of their drinking water, I guess they pretty much got them. It's the next level up.
Let me come back to something we touched on before the last break, and that's nature, because this is kind of important.
Yeah, we have about 3 minutes.
Okay, we got plenty of time. In the Constitution, it says you're entitled to know the nature and cause of the accusation, right?
Yep.
Do you know what they're imputing there in the word nature?
I think they're talking about whether or not your accusation is at law or equity or admiralty or whatever. I think that's what they're talking about. What do you think?
It's the jurisdictional law. And you see, that's the point that John makes, and the reason that we go through a lot of this confusion is in England, all these jurisdictions were separate. They had their own magistrate. They had their own lexicon on what they call the paperwork that was put in. They had their own remedies. Everything was separate and different. And when our people founded the country, they lumped all those jurisdictions together in one court system.
Well, they didn't do it when we founded. They didn't do it when they founded, but they have combined since then.
As it developed. Okay.
Yeah. I don't even know if they've combined the jurisdictions, but what they have combined is the procedures. For example, I believe it was about 1948 where they combined both the procedure of law and the procedure of equity into a single unified federal procedure. And I think it was 1948, but I should know, but I don't right off the top of my head. The point was that prior to that, if you were going to be sued in a court of equity, you could tell from the procedure and from the requirements and the paperwork. They were so much different from whatever was required at law. You could see, oh, okay, I'm in a court of equity. On the other hand, if you're at law, you could see, oh, I'm not in equity. This is at law. And they are, when they combine the two procedures, it's no longer apparent. Are we or are we in equity? Most people think you're going to a court of law. In my opinion, you are generally going to a court of equity or sometimes today administration. But by combining the two procedures, it's no longer apparent.
Right around the Erie versus Tompkins Railroad, Erie Railroad versus Tompkins decision, which stated there is no more federal common law, and I think that's as they progressed their agenda and got rid of those common law courts. Now, as according to Wayne Hayes out there in Nevada, who's dead now, who won his case posthumously at the Supreme Court against a Bureau of Land Management, he said in his video that I saw personally, he said, we have found out the only common law court left in the country is the U.S. Court of Claims.
I've heard those kinds of rumors. I don't know whether they're true or false, but I'll tell you what, Roger, we are down to our last 15 seconds, and we will not discover whether those claims are true or false before the program ends. I want to thank you for being on the program, Roger. I want to thank all you folks for listening. Roger will be back next Tuesday. I'll be back tomorrow with Melody Cedarstrom. In the meantime, I want to thank all of you for listening, and may the good Lord bless you, me, Roger, and Frank, the producer. Bye.
Hasta luego.
Hasta luego.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.